Our guest in this podcast is a man who's done a most interesting book that much appeals to me. That man is, in fact, a member of the same profession in which I labored for many years. He is a psychologist, though apparently a clinical psychologist, as I am not. Gary Greenberg is the author of The Book of Woe, The DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry. DSM, I suppose, for some of our listeners, must be decoded. What is the D? What is the S? What is the M?
Well, the DSM stands for the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, and it's a book published by the American Psychiatric Association. The dry title doesn't really do justice to the significance or the impact of the book. It's really a book. It's a compendium of psychiatric diagnoses, names of psychiatric disorders, and the definition, the criteria by which they are known. It's sort of like a dictionary of mental disorder.
And added to that title, of course, as part of the title, is number 5. This is the fifth time around.
Yes, that's correct. There have been 5 major revisions of the DSM since it came into effect first in 1952.
With regard to defining what the separate disorders, mental disorders, are, why can't these noble psychiatrists make up their mind as to what the diseases are? Internists don't keep inventing new diseases. They've got a roster of them. They discover some new ones, but they don't keep reshuffling them.
Well, that's not entirely true. In regular medicine, in physical medicine, there are situations where diseases that are once thought to be separate diseases turn out to be the same disease.
Yeah, that's true.
Or vice versa. But what the real difference is quantitative. There are no diseases, no psychiatric disorders that can be defined with the same kind of specificity as physical disorders can, for the simple reason that we generally make those distinctions based on physical findings, lab findings, x-rays, that sort of thing. And because the pathology of psychiatric disorder isn't very well understood, or to put that more simply, because we don't really understand how the brain works, it's very difficult to make the kinds of distinctions that we normally make in medicine.
A brief classical quotation from Macbeth. Lady Macbeth is wandering around, sleepwalking, saying that her hands are full of blood. All the perfumes of Arabia will not sweeten this little hand, the rather will it the multitudinous seas incarnadine, is her complaint. Macbeth calls in the local doctor before psychiatry existed as a separate specialty. And here's the dialogue. Macbeth, how does your patient, doctor? Doctor, not so sick, my lord, as she is troubled with thick coming fancies that keep her from rest. Macbeth, cure her of that. Canst thou not minister to a mind diseased? Pluck from the memory a rooted sorrow, graze out the written troubles of the brain, and with some sweet, oblivious antidote, cleanse the stuffed bosom of that perilous stuff which weighs upon her heart. Doctor's response, therein, the patient must minister to himself. To what degree is that like modern psychiatry?
Well, I would say it's interesting. When I was listening to that, I wasn't so much thinking about the psychiatrists. I mean, the doctors being very straightforward and saying, I don't think I have the cure for that. The way that resembles the modern mental health system is from the consumer end, from Macbeth's expectation that the doctor is the right person to take care of his wife's suffering. Or to put that in another way, that her suffering is a medical disease. And I think that's a really interesting gloss on the problem that we face. The problem that we face, while it's easy to blame psychiatrists for the problem, and there are indeed problems that psychiatrists have originated, it's also important to see that the whole system is also consumer-driven, in the sense that many of us do expect that when we suffer mental anguish, that it can be understood in the same way as our physical anguish, and that therefore it can be cured in the same way as our physical problems can be cured, i.e. by a doctor, often with a medication or some other straightforward treatment.
Forgive this, Gary, if I give you a rather lengthy disquisition drawn from philosophy and from linguistics. You remember that Immanuel Kant, among many other things, does note that the use of the names of things tends to block comprehension of what he calls the thing in itself, das Ding an sich. The thing is there. Plato was aware of that as well. Benjamin Whorf, so many years later, as one of the early scientific psychologists, scientific linguists, I should have said, whether he ever read Kant or not, he sees the vocabulary that we have as altering the organizing and organizing the reality that is out there but is known only by naming, which distorts or at least organizes our perception of what it is. Umberto Eco, in The Name of the Rose, is essentially asserting that the name of the rose is not the rose. Though Gertrude Stein said, a rose is a rose is a rose. All of this, it seems to me, should suggest a necessary wariness about reification, that is, about the danger of rendering real conceptual terms, including, of course, the conceptual terms that we use for so-called mental disorder or mental disease. I'm sure you agree with me, and that's one of your main complaints about the DSM. It invents or establishes diagnostic categories which did not exist before, takes away some categories that did exist, and in general, it is a burden to the psychiatrist, sometimes even a burden to the patient. You report of one patient who is screaming to the psychiatrist to take away the diagnosis of a mood disorder, because that sort of condemns him for life. Naming is the problem, isn't it? Yet to do diagnostic work, you've got to use names.
Yes, naming is the problem, but it's important to be clear about this. I mean, we could think of the difficulties with naming, as Kant does, as an ontological problem, a sort of inescapable difficulty of language, that language can only always approximate reality. And Kant's not the only one to make that point, but it's so clear that the thing in itself may or may not exist. You could argue about that, but what is not arguable is the difference between the name for the thing and the thing. Now, all of that's pretty clear, and psychiatrists who write the DSM are upfront about their recognition that all they're doing is creating names. And, in fact, they warn against the dangers of reification, that we should not take as these mental disorders as realities. They're useful constructs. Now, the problem with that is that despite those disclosures, and despite those disclaimers, I should say, there's also a strong tendency within psychiatry to insist that the disorders that are named in the DSM are real. And the reason that that's the case is because unless you're treating real disorders, then you're not a real doctor. And this is the problem of the DSM, not that it's reified, but that there's bad faith, that there's a discrepancy.
And there's between there is the economic reality, which, of course,
This is what drives it.
And explain what that is. It has to do with payment for services rendered.
Right. It has to do with that, because everybody who is treated for mental health issues, if they want their insurance to pay for it, needs to get a diagnosis, and the diagnoses have to be diagnoses that the insurance companies will recognize as real, in the same way that they recognize diabetes or cancer as real. And this has created the impetus for creating a DSM, which has a scientific rhetoric, but isn't scientific in the sense that it names diseases that can be verified by looking at under a microscope. So that part of it is pretty clear, that the economics drives it. But there's more general ways that the economics drives it, having to do with the status of psychiatry, and also, more important, having to do with the way research is funded. Research on mental disorders is funded largely through diagnoses. If you want to get your research grant funded by the National Institute of Health, you've got to have a disorder that you're researching, or if you want to have your drug approved, if you're a drug company, it's got to be tied to the treatment of a disorder. So in this case, in these examples, the reification is something that is necessary in order to have the money that you need to do what you want to do.
You are a clinical psychologist. I'm merely a social psychologist. But as such, I've been very fascinated by the way in which reification reaches the general public. A fellow, this is going way back, long before the years of the DSM, a psychologist named Morton Prince thought that he had discovered something new, namely multiple personality disorder. And he wrote about it in those days, and that got a good deal of journalistic cover. This is back into the first decade, I think, or certainly by the second decade of the 20th century. And multiple personality presentations began to appear much more frequently in medical practice. Then, many years later, there were a few films, particularly the one called Sybil, which was all built on a woman having 13 different personalities and so on. And I'm told by psychiatric friends, and I guess I've seen this written up as well, that once that film appeared, and then some others imitating it, multiple personality disorder became almost as common as the common cold. Whereas, somehow in Western Europe, to which we might legitimately compare ourselves, it did not really appear as a psychiatric category, did not appear as a disease that people encountered. It's obvious that the concept of a certain mode of pathology, legitimated by medical affirmation, tends to produce more, shall we say, imitations, or simply more indulgence in the routines of that pathology.
Well, that's one way to look at it. Another, and I think that's true, but another way to look at it that might also be true is that these disease labels, like multiple personality disorder, give people a way to conceptualize their suffering. So you could think of the DSM as a language that doctors use to diagnose people, but you could also think of it as a language that people use to understand their own experience, particularly when their experience is disturbing or upsetting. There's actually a very good book about on this very subject. It's called Crazy Like Us, and it's by a San Francisco journalist named Ethan Waters. And in it, he goes around the world and he shows how the DSM vocabulary of mental suffering has come to change the way people in countries that didn't have the DSM previously, but then it was introduced, how those people changed their understanding of their suffering. Multiple personality disorder is one of the best examples of that. It's possible that what happens there is that people who are feeling sort of split off from themselves and confused and so on get this label, get this understanding.
They get a new scenario, in effect, don't they?
Exactly, and they see something like Three Faces of Eve or Sybil or something like that. Or if you maybe remember the satanic cult ritual abuse epidemic, which was thought of as the cause of a lot of multiple personality disorder, and they come not only to invent a symptomatology for themselves, but also they invent a history for themselves. And it turns out that, as we know, human memory is very fallible, very, very malleable, and so the whole thing taken together means that psychiatric diagnosis has a huge impact that nobody recognizes, not having to do with anything that we were talking about previously, but having to do with the way people understand their lives.
You know, again, a Shakespearean line comes to me, all the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players. You're saying that we organize ourselves, the selves that we present to others and to ourselves, in some part based upon what the technically competent people supposedly are telling us are the varieties of human experience and of human performance.
Yes, that's exactly right. And so that puts an undue burden on those people who are in authority. They have power. And it's very poorly understood, not just by psychiatrists and not just by doctors, but by many professionals, what exactly it means to have that kind of power in a culture like ours. Even when they do understand it, it's very hard to keep a check on it. I mean, I'm a therapist, and I'm constantly working with people or against people's expectations that I have some kind of authoritative, objective knowledge of what's going on with them. I mean, I might be a little bit ahead of them in the darkness, but to think that I, you know, have some kind of scientific understanding of what's going on with them, I constantly have to disabuse people of that notion.
What is the way in which they actually put this volume together? I know that the man who put the last one together, the DSM-4, condemns the present newly published DSM-5. It's not all the work of a single man. There are committees of psychiatrists who are working all of this up for years and years before they publish the next edition. Isn't that right?
This particular revision took 15 years from the time it was conceived to the time it actually emerged.
How much does it differ from number four?
Well, it's not that much, especially not compared to the hopes for it in the beginning. The hope for the DSM-5 in the beginning was that it would finally be a DSM that was pegged to neuroscience. That problem with that was the neuroscience, this was an idea that came out at the end of the 1990s, and the neuroscience just hadn't progressed to that point, and it still hasn't. So it's basically organized in a similar fashion, although they did make some changes. Cynics, or maybe just skeptics, say that all they've done is rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic. Now, I can tell you a little about the process by which it's made, if you'd like.
Please.
Okay. So what happens here is that the American Psychiatric Association owns the DSM. They have a publishing wing, and they have intellectual property rights over all of the diagnostic names and criteria. And so what they do is they solicit volunteers to among psychiatrists, and mostly among academic psychiatrists, to form committees to investigate areas of diagnostic categories, so mood disorders or psychotic disorders and that kind of thing. And those groups, called work groups, usually around 10 people, they hash out the issues. They talk about what isn't working in the DSM. They talk about what research has shown and what clinicians like and don't like about the DSM. And based on that, they suggest changes. And it's basically a legislative process. There's a lot of arguing. There's a lot of disagreement. There's a lot of controversy even any time they revise the DSM. And it goes through this process for a number of years, meetings every month and so on, until finally they put together the new book.
There are, of course, also social policy, or one might even say political consequences, depending upon the new decisions concerning diagnosis. The crucial case in point, of course, was that in the preparation of, was it three or four, they took off the index of disorder the condition or the situation of homosexuality. That was, in fact, which in DSM-2, or was it 3, was still listed as a psychiatric disorder.
DSM-2, which was published in 1968, still listed homosexuality. I almost said psychiatry as a mental disorder. Homosexuality as a mental disorder.
Well, then there was a big campaign. This is what interests me as a social psychologist. There was a big campaign organized by major homosexual organizations, with many of them featuring psychiatrists who happened to be also homosexual, who petitioned and pressed and agitated to the American Psychiatric Association to delist it, to take homosexuality off the list of disorders. And that was submitted to a general vote, which is a rare thing, I guess, in the writing of the DSM. And the psychiatrists voted by majority, what size, I don't know, to decommission the pathologization of homosexuality. What do you make of that kind of process?
Well, what I make of it is what's obvious, which is that it's a political process and not a scientific process. The vote was somewhere in the neighborhood of 65-35%, and it was done by referendum. But that was after the process that I just described had come to the conclusion that homosexuality should be deleted. The reason there was a referendum was because there was a rearguard movement within the American Psychiatric Association to prevent that change, and so it was thought the best thing to do would be to put it to a vote of the membership. And that was in 1973, after two or three years of pretty intense agitating, as you said. And what's interesting about this is that by doing the right thing, I mean, in my view anyway, the right thing was to delete homosexuality. I don't believe that it's a mental disorder. By doing the right thing, the American Psychiatric Association also revealed what the problem is with the DSM, which is that diseases can come and go. A whole group of people can suddenly be cleared of a disease simply with the stroke of a pen. That just isn't supposed to happen in medicine. And as a result of the homosexuality crisis, as well as a couple of other related crises in psychiatry around the same time, psychiatry came into some real trouble. Insurers and the government were reluctant to continue to fund it because they were saying, look, you guys don't know what your diseases you're treating. You don't know how to define a mental disorder. Why should we pay for this? This isn't real medicine. And it was as a result of that that the modern DSM, the DSM-3, which came out in 1980, was invented. It was invented in order to apply a scientific rhetoric to the DSM for that largely economic and political reason, to establish the credentials and the legitimacy of psychiatry.
It also does something else. It fully codifies and declares a case closed on a very important issue that once was a considerable controversy in the clinical psychiatric psychological realm. That is, the controversy was over whether there were organic bases or genetic bases or biochemical bases for some disorders, and whether others were essentially a term that used to be used, functional, that is to say, experiential, based upon what had happened in the life of the individual. Psychoanalysis, a system now largely discredited and no longer used except in a few big cities where movie stars can afford to spend 10 years on the couch. But psychoanalysis basically viewed the troubled minds or the troubled personalities of its patients as due to experiential traumatization of one sort or another, usually, of course, having in classic form a strong sexual component. Psychiatry seems to have decided not only do you throw away psychoanalysis, which I think is a good idea, since it was never a science and can easily be disconfirmed in many ways, but that you throw away the notion that people can be mentally burdened, emotionally burdened, over long periods of their lives because of what they've gone through, rather than because of some biochemical dysfunction or some inherent genetic disposition or what have you. To me, who got training in this when I was a graduate student in psychology 1,000 years ago, the distinction between functional and organic still had some significance. Now apparently it has none.
Well, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? I mean, the official line on all of that is that psychiatrists are agnostic on the subject of nature versus nurture, if you will. You know, how much of the mental suffering is just sort of stuff that happens bad in your brain, and how much of it is a result of your experience, and they settle for a kind of a mushy ecumenicism. But in fact, what's happened in real life is that the distinction has been lost between the kind of suffering that is the result of experience and the kind that may be the result of just a bad luck, an accident, something gone wrong in the brain that has nothing to do with anything. And that distinction got lost when the DSM-3 came out. It was an intentional loss. They said, let's get rid of it. It's too hard to figure this out. And as a result, as science and neuroscience have become a stronger force, the presumption is that all mental suffering is brain disorder.
And should show, if you can't yet discover it, eventually you will, a biogenic base, which has to be specified.
Yes, so even if there's not an overt commitment to saying what you just said, that all psychiatric suffering is the result of a biochemical problem, the implicit assumption is indeed that. And, of course, that's where all the money goes these days, especially at the National Institute of Health level.
That's the pharmacological frontier of psychiatry.
Yeah, and of course they'll deny, and to some extent it's true, they're not out to, you know, make the drug companies rich, but the prejudice is so strong, the congruence among the researchers is so strong that these things are best understood as biochemical problems, that indeed, you know, after a while you see what you look for, and you look for what you know, and increasingly what we know, or think we know, is brain chemistry.
And that has led to an interesting division of labor, as I understand it. Almost all psychiatrists will diagnose on the basis of the DSM or maybe their own systems, but then assume there is a biochemical basis for the disorder and will find some drugs to prescribe, and you don't have long-term treatment or long-term therapy. The patient may be asked to come back in 6 months to see how that drug is working for him. Psychotherapy, the so-called, quote, talking cure, is done now by people like you, by psychologists, and for that matter, by psychiatric social workers, I suppose, and Lord knows, and people who call themselves counselors and Lord knows what other categories. But the psychiatrists have eschewed doing psychotherapy. And that all the other mental health workers are doing it, thus assuming that you still have to look for what went wrong in the formative experiences that shaped the life that I've now got before me and in my hands.
Yeah, I think that's right. You can call that a division of labor, and in some ways it's self-reinforcing. Many psychiatrists, I'm in my 50s, and many psychiatrists who are my age are right on the cusp of this change, and they are dismayed by the fact that they're no longer really paid to do therapy as much as they want to. And as you get younger, as your psychiatrists, the likelihood that you've even been trained as a therapist decreases, which means that the people who are going into the field are that much more likely to be pharmacologically oriented. And so it becomes a kind of a vicious circle in which the people that are more likely to go into the profession are the people that are more likely to want to practice that way. And so they end up practicing basically medication management.
Let me put to you three or four hypothetical people and tell me what a psychiatrist would do with them. Somebody comes in, a long bereaved widower. His wife died 2 years ago, and he's still mourning and still feeling very, very lonely and unhappy. Another one who presents himself is a child brought in by his parents who's about 7 or 8 years old and is unattentive and, quote, disruptive in school. Yet another, well, let me add as a third, then there's a psychiatrist himself who's in the Army and on the basis of strong religious preoccupations, decides one day to go out and find other soldiers about to be shipped off to the Middle East and to kill them. That's Major Nidal. We're still waiting for the verdict in his case. Would every one of those be, by a standard modern psychiatrist, be classified as mentally disordered or otherwise?
Well, of course, they could be. Anybody can be diagnosed because if their symptoms reach a level of what's called clinical significance, then they warrant a diagnosis. Now, in the cases that you just talked about, if in the first case, the long bereaved widower, if a psychiatrist determines that he meets the criteria for, let's say, major depressive disorder.
What are those criteria?
What are they?
Yeah.
Well, there's 9 criteria for major depressive disorder that include things like being unhappy for more than 2 weeks on end.
I would think you could legitimately be unhappy at the death of your wife than 2 weeks.
That's right. So let's assume this person meets the criteria and that his suffering is determined by the psychiatrist to be clinically significant, for which there is no real objective measure. That's one of the problems here. It's not unlikely that person's going to be diagnosed with a depressive mood disorder or possibly with something that's called adjustment disorder, although with the 2-year time frame, that's a little less likely. The psychiatrist may or may not decide that person should have antidepressant treatment. But let me be clear about that, because the connection between diagnosis and treatment is not as immediate as people might think it is. Most antidepressants, something like 3/4 of them, of the prescriptions written for them, are written in the absence of a diagnosis, of a psychiatric diagnosis. And most of those are written by family doctors. So the diagnosis doesn't necessarily determine the treatment, but in this case, it very well might. As for the child who comes in with the description that he's been disruptive, etc., again, there's a number of possible diagnoses. One of them is something called conduct disorder.
Uh-huh.
Another one is called oppositional defiant disorder. And a third one...
Hold on one second. Either way, isn't he likely to have Ritalin prescribed for him?
No, actually not. Not for the ones... I mean, one of the functions of diagnoses that I think is quite legitimate is to try to isolate groups of people who shouldn't be given drugs. While I don't think there's a direct... or particular drugs. I don't think there's a direct line from diagnosis to treatment. There can be a direct line from diagnosis to not treatment. And kids who are diagnosed with oppositional defiant or the one I was about to talk about, which is disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, they may not be given Ritalin, at least in theory. The idea of giving kids like that stimulants, the reason to give them their own diagnosis as opposed to attention deficit hyperactivity disorder is because they may do worse on stimulants. However, usually the way that's discovered is not by diagnosis, but by giving them the stimulants, because that is the first line of treatment often, and seeing what happens. And sometimes what happens is pretty bad. Was it Major Nidal?
Major Nidal.
The Army psychiatrist who I believe was found guilty today.
He was.
On all counts, yes. You know, that's an interesting question, too. It does seem that we want to account for what in an earlier age would have been called evil with psychiatric or what might have been called in the past, political terrorism. Under the gaze of the psychiatrist, can easily become a mental disorder. And I don't think that that's happened with Nidal. Frankly, I haven't followed that story that closely, but I haven't heard that he's been given a diagnosis. However, we have many, many examples of people who have committed acts that they themselves, which are heinous, but which they themselves say are politically motivated. And and those people are then diagnosed, even in the absence of good, solid clinical evidence. The test case for that would be Theodore Kaczynski, the Unabomber,
yes,
who was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic in the absence of almost any obvious, not just obvious, but on psychiatric examination, not so obvious symptomatology of schizophrenia. And that case was a really good example of how a set of crimes became pathologized as symptoms of psychiatric.
Would you guess from a distance that in fact Kaczynski did suffer schizophrenia?
Well, I have more than a distant view of Ted Kaczynski. I had a 2-year correspondence with him.
Really? Oh my goodness!
Yes, in the aftermath of his conviction, when I saw that he'd been diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, and I am familiar with the history of political agitators and psychiatrists, and I saw that as an example. Without wanting to condone what Kaczynski did,
yeah.
I thought it should be condemned on its own virtues, not on as a result of a mental disorder. And I entered into a long and tangled correspondence with him, which people could read about on my website.
How fascinating! What did you learn about him?
I learned that he's a very super rational man. he's a pain in the neck, and he's excuse me. He's obviously got some ideas about how to change society that are reprehensible, and his morals are not where they should be. But he's not mentally ill. Unless you decide that those things are inherently mentally ill, I have a thick sheaf of correspondence with the man in which he shows himself to be a reasonably reasonable person. Now, that said, there is no reason, given that the DSM is 1,000 pages long and has 250 diagnoses in it, it'd be easy to find a diagnosis that would fit him, as it would be for almost anybody, certainly somebody who's lived a life like he has. But paranoid schizophrenia, that was not it.
It's interesting, on the series that we're doing now, these podcasts, my guest a few weeks ago, and he's up on our website, and my interview with him can be heard, was David Gelernter of Yale University, who has a mangled hand due to his having received a Kaczynski bomb.
Right, and Gelernter's take on that whole experience is quite interesting and in most respects admirable. He, interestingly, I don't know what he's up to these days, but when I was familiar with what he was saying about that horrible event that happened to him, was that, Kaczynski was just trying to take a shortcut to fame, which I can understand as the guy on the wrong end of that bomb why you would come up with that explanation, but you can see in his explanation the attempt to defuse the, if you'll pardon the expression, the political aspect of Kaczynski's behavior.
All in all, is psychiatry worth our expenditure of time and, more importantly, of money? Or is it a kind
we
of
don't know the,
or is it a kind of a con game which has been worked on us for the last 100 years?
We don't know the answer to that question. We won't know. It's a hard thing to say. I mean, let's bear in mind, in 1939, the guy that won the Nobel Prize for Medicine is the guy that invented the frontal lobotomy.
Yes, yes.
And at the time, it seemed like he deserved it. These things don't become clear until years and years later, which is quite frightening when you consider that lobotomy was a relatively rare procedure, but, you know, one in five American adult women is taking antidepressants. Will that turn out to have been a problem? Will they look back on this and say, God, that was like the Romans drinking water out of lead pipes? I honestly don't know. It is, but the dismaying thing is it is possible. It is possible that psychiatry is, despite its the integrity of some of its practitioners, despite its good intentions, that psychiatry is a confidence game. That is a possibility. And it's a very disturbing possibility. And when you look back, as I did in my book, at the history of this whole question of what is a mental disorder and which ones exist, and you see that over and over again, since the 1880s, psychiatrists have recognized that unless they figure that out, they don't have a legitimate practice. And they spent 140 years trying to establish their credibility to inspire our confidence in them by having disease categories, and they're still, in 2013, unable to really give us diseases in the same way that an endocrinologist can tell us about diseases. It's very disturbing.
Look at the structure of the typical confidence game, and you see a great parallel to psychiatric practice. It begins by hooking the mark. The mark is the victim in con man terminology. Hooking him with a scare, and then with a promised delivery from that with which you've scared him, or with an opportunity to make a lot of gain that is illegitimate, but that will serve him well, and you can both share the secret. Once you've hooked him, you also snow him with evidence of your status and your expertise and your esoteric wisdom. That holds him to you for a while. Then in the next stage, once you've got what you want from him, in this case it's essentially patient comportment and conformity and fees, obviously, and a basis for charging the treatment that you've done, which for psychiatrists is only rather short-term and is essentially prescribing of drugs rather than psychotherapy. In the third stage, then, you prescribe the drugs which may or may not work for you, you tell him. And the fourth phase is what the confidence men call cooling out the mark, so he won't sue you or complain or go to the cops for real confidence rackets. There's a certain parallel there between the classic confidence game and the modern psychiatric encounter.
Yes, I'm a little leery of getting totally behind that comment, except to go back to what I said earlier, which is that this is a possibility. I mean, what you've just described is certainly the way Ponzi schemes work, but some of it is also the way that just American mass consumer society works.
Oh, and with something else, with belief on the part of the psychiatrist that he's doing legitimate things. I'm not suggesting that he, like the con man, knows that he's cheating. He doesn't know that. He needs to believe in himself and in his virtue as somebody providing service and even salvation.
Right, and what I would say about that is that confidence is the central issue when it comes to psychiatry. And that has a resonance with something else that we know about mental health treatment, which is that mental health treatment, like most medical treatment, depends a lot on the placebo effect. And I don't mean that in a disparaging way. The placebo effect is responsible for an awful lot of healing. But if a patient doesn't have confidence in their doctor, the placebo effect can be disabled. So confidence is the key to this. Now, whether or not that's being used in an appropriate or legitimate way, as I say, this is what remains to be seen. Psychiatrists have not done a very good job of defending themselves about this. They tend to disparage and diagnose their critics rather than respond in a kind of constructive way to the obvious, and every day it becomes more obvious, lack of solid scientific knowledge in their field. I do think that it's worthwhile to at least consider the possibility that this is a confidence game.
You and I are both PhDs in psychology, and you're a clinical psychologist. For a long time, there was a sort of a war raging between the two APAs, American Psychiatric Association, American Psychological Association, and some tension between the two professions. I'm not as much in those circles as once I was. Does that tension, does that conflict still persist?
Well, I would say yes and no. There are factions within the American Psychological Association that have taken the DSM on head on. Largely the humanistic psychology section and other related groups. But in the big picture, I think the American Psychological Association has been happy to ride the coattails of the psychiatrists because, and all of us who are in the field, the therapy field, you know, we have benefited greatly from the presence of this book because it's what allows us to cash in on our insurance chips. And so I think it's important that you make this point and that I answer by saying that tension may still be there at some level, but when it comes to diagnosis, especially diagnosing for dollars, it's not really there.
If I'm correctly informed, you do not avail yourself of those categories and don't avail yourself of medical insurance on the part of the
patients. No, that's not entirely correct. I discourage the use of insurance. There's all sorts of things that I do to try to minimize mine and my client's exposure to it, but I don't refuse. And if it's the only way a person can pay for therapy, then that's what we do. But I try to inform them that this diagnosis goes on their permanent medical record.
Gary, we are. And I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, and I was just going to say, you know, I try to do it with full disclosure and full consent.
I was almost interrupting you because I know you're time-bound, as indeed are we, and it is time to close. I've enjoyed this conversation tremendously, and I thank you very much for joining us. Let's make clear to all who are listening that the book by Gary Greenberg, which is the basis for the conversation we've just had, though there's much more in that book, to be sure, is titled The Book of Woe. And it's not a woeful read. It's a fascinating read. Thanks once again for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.